Restorative justice is a theory of justice that emphasizes repairing the harm caused by criminal behavior. Practices and programs reflecting restorative purposes will respond to crime by identifying and taking steps to repair harm, involving all stakeholders, and transforming the traditional relationship between communities and government in responding to crime. We hear, it seems often still today, about restorative justice and situations that are seemingly resolved by it. And let's find out a little bit more, a lot more in fact, about how restorative justice is set up and how it works. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. My guest is Jonathan Schar, director of the Restorative Justice Project at the UW Law School, and welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Norman.
Restorative justice seems a fairly recent term, but is the concept fairly old of this kind of, I'll call it reconciliation?
Well, it's even a tricky term, right? So thinking about this element of reconciliation, but that draws really to a bit of the root in North America and thinking of the sort of Western movement of restorative justice, which really came about around the 1970s is when it sort of rose a bit to prominence. But it really draws on a great deal of practices that have a much, much sort of deeper root that draws to sort of First Nations and Indigenous cultures and traditions really throughout the world, certainly in North America, but also if you wanted to sort of extend both in sort of Africa and in Asia and Europe, Australia, New Zealand.
Yeah. And the concept has really taken off since the 70s, though.
Yes, dramatically. I mean, as we have sought to understand what happens, one, in these processes, as well as in sort of looking at the effectiveness, we've continued to sort of study restorative justice, and particularly even in, you know, as it relates to sort of corrections and sort of our criminal legal system. And so we've seen a lot of studies, both nationally as well as sort of internationally, that have been looking at this sort of effectiveness of this, again, alternative process to our traditional criminal legal system, as well as sort of our traditional sort of punitive or carceral processes that we have in our traditional justice systems.
It seems that there are two sides to it. One would be the, whatever you want to call it, criminal perpetrator, the accused on the one hand, and on the other, what term do you want to use? Not just victim anymore, is it?
No, it's not. It's a sense of understanding that when we're looking at harm, it's the easiest to sort of understand when we look at something broad like harmed party. And so you have individuals, and you've seen a lot of evolution in language of individuals who don't necessarily want to or don't identify themselves with sort of the victim space. And so we can look at victim survivor or survivors of crime, as well as even beyond that to sort of thrivers in the aftermath who've been able to, you know, sort of move in a dramatic healing fashion to sort of a much better space for themselves.
What is the goal?
So the goal of restorative justice is really, again, sort of addressing harm that has been done, not just to individuals, but also looking through this idea of the ripple effect more broadly at the people sort of around them in their lives. So that looks at the harm that has happened to their families, to their friends, to their communities, taking this much more sort of communal approach to it and understanding that what someone does, specifically an act of crime or a harm, has broad-ranging impacts in the way that it ripples both out through different individuals, but also out through a person's life. And so the way that that may manifest, looking at the impacts of crime or harm, and then restorative justice by changing and focusing where that lens is, right? Like, where do we put our focal point of justice to the person who's experienced harm, and instead looking at their needs versus intensely focusing on the person responsible, which is really what the traditional system does. What we seek to do then is look at what needs arise out of whatever harm or criminal act that's occurred, and then finding ways to address those harms.
Does that include also, it's kind of a sidebar, I guess, but does it include also harm done to, what term do you want to use here, the perpetrators?
Sure,
friends, family, relations.
Yeah, so again, broadly thinking about the responsible party, right? The person who's responsible for the harm. And if we would think about this idea of, you know, the ripple effect, right? Just if you sort of dropped a, you know, a pebble into a stream, you'd have ripples that go out in both directions. And so those same individuals exist in a responsible party's life that exists in a harm party's life, right? They also have family, friends, you know, siblings and people that are around them that are also impacted by their actions and when they commit a crime. There's a lot of ways in which that negative ripple ripples out and impacts them as well in a whole bunch of different ways.
Well, we're making the distinction here between a civil and a criminal case.
Certainly. So the sense, I mean, you can still use restorative justice in either context, right? The sense of when we broadly think about harm, obviously, if you're talking about a crime, then you're sort of talking sure. about the criminal context. But there is the use of restorative justice or restorative practices that can happen in sort of a civil system or in lieu of a sort of civil legal system response as well.
When we refer to crime, then it's a given that the person doing the harm mm-hmm. has been convicted?
So not necessarily. Restorative justice can be used in a broad variety of contexts. So anywhere looking from diversion, right? So the sense of setting up or utilizing restorative justice as an alternate practice, deflecting someone from our traditional legal system that can be used, again, rather than going through court to, you know, provide an alternate response, a restorative response to individuals that are impacted, right? So both to the harm party as well as to the responsible party, that then also often engages community members in, you know, thinking about what is an appropriate resolution to this case, like what would need to be done in order to move forward in a positive direction for harm party, community, and responsible party.
Would the responsible party already be incarcerated under these circumstances?
So there's a couple circumstances where that is the case. I mean, so in the serious and sensitive crime work that we do, where we're dealing most frequently with sort of survivors of either homicide or some sort of sexual-based harm, sexual-based crime, frequently those individuals are either incarcerated or they're at least post-adjudication, meaning they have been sentenced and maybe they're on, you know, extended supervision or they're on probation or parole. But likewise, we can, again, utilize this process as a diversion, right, coming up with what is the appropriate response, or even concurrently with a criminal process that's happening, whether that's sort of pre-plea or even, again, sort of post-plea, in thinking about how does this inform what a court of law does, right? Like, how does it inform what a sentence may be appropriate or, again, what does a sort of victim of crime or a survivor of crime want to see happen?
If we look at cases, where does the initiative come from when it comes to this matter of restorative justice?
Yeah. So in the serious and sensitive crime work that we do in our clinic, where we're working, again, with very high-level crimes, right? Again, so frequently, like I said, sort of homicide or sexual assault cases. All of those are victim-initiated, right? So it comes from the harm party that we really want to be sort of victim-focused, victim-centered, and looking at their space first as the most directly impacted party, right? So again, restorative justice, we're shifting both who has the power, right? So the sense that we think about our traditional legal system, it's state versus an individual. We think about things in restorative justice, it's about, again, focusing on the victim and starting there and then looking at, again, what they need. And so we don't necessarily set them up as adversarial parties of this person versus this person. We do look there first. So we want to be respectful and responsive to that harmed party. And so especially in the higher level cases, we always, those are sort of victim initiated, at least here in Wisconsin and sort of in our program. It, you know, certainly possible that they could look at different approaches and you may have sort of different outreach that may occur if we're talking about a diversion program, right, where they might be looking at a responsible party who's appropriate for some sort of alternate or diversionary process to deflect them out of our criminal legal system. But even there, you should be, again, getting permission and consent of the victim and actively inviting them into the process. When we think about this idea of really centering on the harmed party, we really have to start with them and it be something that they want to choose for themselves.
In a play-by-play, then, step-by-step process, let's say there is a conviction. Mm-hmm. Somebody has been convicted of murdering, let's say, a family member. Mm-hmm. At what point in this process would you even raise this issue of restorative justice to the harmed party?
Well, so that's an interesting thing, right? So there's no automatic right or no automatic trigger of notification that occurs in our traditional criminal legal system. And that's been one of the things that people have found, challenging or more frustrating. That sense of, I've met with dozens and dozens and dozens of people who've come and request their services that said they didn't know that we existed or didn't know that this was available to them, that they hadn't been, notified about it. How that's, I think, developed. So as, moving forward with truth in sentencing and moving forward from the year 2000 with the creation of the Wisconsin Department of Corrections Office of Victim Services and Programs, there's been the development of sort of a relationship there where there's, again, sort of a post-adjudication victim services piece that didn't exist, right, sort of pre-2000. And so if we're talking about more recent cases, there, hopefully is some sort of notification or some potential discussion of it. But understanding that even in those spaces, right, maybe right at conviction or right after conviction, there's a very large amount of information that, a survivor or victim of crime may receive. And so in there should be a piece of paper that says something about this. But, when you think about experiencing the trauma, both of the harm, but then also the impact of sort of being involved in the criminal system and going through that, a lot of people are in a tough spot.
Yeah, and I think that's often overlooked by people who are not in that situation, is how long these things can go on, especially if a more severe sentence is sought, so that the harmed person has to keep living with this over, day after day, while the court system works through it.
Yeah, and that's been one of the most beautiful things that we've been able to offer people. One is, frankly, a common language explanation of what happened, right? That sense of looking at the court record, looking at the things that have happened, and being able to sort of sit with them and answer any questions that they may have about what happened or why did a particular person do a thing, right? So why was a particular motion filed, or why did they plead this way, or why did a judge say this or do this? So being able to sort of sit with survivors, one, in that sort of space and explaining what happened in their case, whether it's to them or to a loved one, but then also being able to, in a lot of ways, come in and, hopefully fix a lot of the damage that may have occurred or happened to them, not just by the other individual, but also by the way in which the system may not have been that responsive to them or being sensitive to their needs or thinking about things like all the days that they may have had to take off of work, right, to honor their loved one, or the transportation, or that sense of, what does it mean to have to be there, so that the psychological and emotional toll, even of engaging with our traditional legal processes, are challenging. And so when we look at a restorative process where we're able to just sort of exist, meet them where they're at, and then walk with them along that journey, hopefully of healing, right, to find answers to their questions. And often these questions are things that are not necessarily relevant, right, in a court proceeding.
What sort of, I'll use the term qualifications, I guess, for lack of a better one, or what kind of field are these facilitators coming from? Are they attorneys, or are they psychologists, or?
Sure. So there's no specific requirement as to what one person must be in order to be a facilitator. There's also, again, since this exists at a wide variety of contexts and different levels. I mean, you have everything from restorative justice or restorative practices, in the K-12 arena, to things that happen on campus, to sort of our criminal legal system. I would really say that individuals with education, experience, and background in each of those relevant fields are particularly helpful. But again, it can be any of those things, right? From attorneys to social workers to, clinicians of sort of a wide variety of spaces. But again, getting training and experience specifically in these sort of restorative elements. For the work that we're doing both in sort of the diversion space, as well as, again, in the aftermath of serious or violent crime, I found it's been incredibly helpful in training law students and in working with attorneys in that space, or again, individuals who may have been victim advocates with knowledge and experience with the systems themselves, again, to be able to look at records and explain what's happened and get a lot of questions answered that they otherwise may not have.
And these individuals, I'll call them facilitators, are assigned to do this, otherwise, everybody's very busy and they have one of these things that comes up. How do they make time for it.
Yeah. Well, so it really depends on what program you may be with. I mean, there are specific county-based programs or programs that are funded through the county that support sort of nonprofit organizations. So there's several nonprofit organizations in Dane County and really throughout the entire state of Wisconsin that engage with these processes, both with youth, juveniles and adults, again, in sort of often lower level crimes, sort of at this sort of post-adjudication level in serious and sensitive crimes. So our clinical program has a relationship with the Department of Corrections that for all the sort of prison-based cases, that those all do flow through us, right, from that office, whether someone finds us on the internet or, again, emails me directly or finds us on the DOC website or some other way, makes their way to us. And so again, for these cases, primarily that's us.
But you say it's initiated by the harmed person.
Correct.
What form then does it take once this harmed person gets in touch and they actually are articulating that they want some kind of resolution?
Yeah. So a lot of times the sense of, people have a bunch of different goals, but they sort of fall into, several major buckets, I guess, would be the way to characterize it in thinking about questions that they have that they want answered. Like one sort of general bucket may be, again, if they weren't present or, they weren't sort of the direct victim, especially, again, sort of homicide cases or things like that, they want to know what happened, right? And they want to know what happened from the person responsible for that, right? And not only what happened, right, there's things that might be relevant to specifically proving a criminal case, but what happened beforehand, right? How or why did you pick my loved one, right? Understanding sort of the why motivations of things. And a why question isn't just one simple why. There's so many things that sort of feed into what led a person even to a place that they could engage in particular behavior or end up committing a specific crime. So learning information about that, right? So understanding what happened, why, how, and then also the who, right? The person behind it. Who is this individual? Because often that's limited as a very, very narrow view of someone, again, being presented a picture of them in the court proceeding by your district attorney, presenting a view of them.
Well, on the one hand, the view they would get in the court proceeding would be probably one, to put a little cynical twist on it, concocted by the defense attorney. And suddenly, they're clean cut, they're wearing glasses, they're in a suit, which could have been for the first time in their lives. They're creating, in other words, an image of this defendant. So deal with that?
Yeah, I would push back against that a little bit in the same way that the exact same thing happens on the other side, right? That it's about creating a particular image of someone that is often very othering. This someone who is whether you throw around the euphemisms as right, sort of a dangerous monster or someone who's irredeemable so I would say it is, that's about that process, right? That's the sense of the criminal legal system, which may be about creating, some sort of palatable, simplistic narrative rather than understanding all of the nuance and pieces of a person's life that go into, again, who they are. So that's like I said, this idea of why. To me, that doesn't start, the day of the offense. That sense of like, all right, what led you to this space? Which means we got to explore a whole bunch of things about an individual from, again, their past. And again, I'll tell you, like lots of survivors have been interested of who was this person while they were growing up.
In all of this, where does the truth stand?
Yeah, so the way that I think about it, if we look at sort of, again, whether you're talking about theories of prosecution, theories of defense, right? In the legal world, we talk about if you're crafting a case, it's all about theme and theory, right? The sense of what is a particular story or narrative, again, on either side that you can sort of pitch to or sell to a jury or a judge that is believable, which again, it's sort of, even thinking about investigation or police work or those sort of things, a lot of times this is sort of our best guess of how do we put together the pieces that we have and recognizing that there's very, very little incentive for people actually to say what happened or to take sort of true or full accountability, because the more accountable someone is held, well, our response is then we're just going to punish them more significantly, right? So that's why we see the things like minimization or deflection or diffusion of blame, or thinking about this idea of our system isn't about accountability, right? Like our system is kryptonite to accountability because it just goes to say, like, again, the more I take responsibility for what I've done, the longer my sentence is going to be.
Yes, yeah, so it is antithetical, isn't it, to telling it the way it was.
And so you ask a sense of, so where is truth found? And I'll tell you, I get lots of people that may ask me, like, well, Jonathan, how do you know that they're telling the truth? And I'll say, well, you know, certainly at the end of the day, we can never be 100% certain, and we won't know. But what we've seen a lot of times, and I find this is, again, a bit of a thought experiment, is you don't often see people taking more responsibility, you know, as a form of a lie, you know, to tell me they were more involved, or, you know, maybe it wasn't as it was presented in court, right, or what was said. Maybe they weren't just sort of standing there, or they weren't just a lookout. I mean, there have been some really dramatic sort of revelations around people's sort of, again, sort of involvement or things that have done, or, you know, who did what in a particular situation. Sense of, again, we're looking post-adjudication, so a sense of, like, a prosecution is done, they're already sentenced, right? They're already incarcerated.
They're not going to get a longer sentence,
right? So there's
not the
incentive, like, it's very little incentive, and there is no, I mean, they don't experience any sort of benefit. We talk about that at the start, is like, look, this is voluntary participation. You know, there's no benefit to your sentence for doing this. You don't get any reduction in time. You know, we don't necessarily have sort of, you know, traditional good time in our state, and it's not one of the factors that's sort of looked at for parole or anything like that. So it's like, if you want to do this, well, what are your goals? And a lot of times it's because two main things. One, they actually are, like, remorseful for what has happened, right? They regret doing what they have done. Some people might question, well, is it, you know, are you remorseful for being, you know, that you did it, or that you got caught and you're dealing with sentence? And okay, I don't think those things have to, you know, doesn't have to necessarily be one or both. I think both can be true.
Sure.
As well as a lot of people, you know, pushing back to this idea of the narrative that gets presented, a lot of them want to correct the image of them that was presented in court that says, I wasn't that person that was presented, I'm not that monster, or I'm a very different person now, right, than the person who may have done this. And then talking about sort of their evolution or growth that they have done, or, you know, programming or ways that they've sort of taken responsibility. So we actually do see a surprising amount of individuals, even in these sort of most serious cases, approximately 80% of people we reach out to who are, again, incarcerated or in our community responsible for harm do agree to participate. So there is, again, a real desire and a hunger for this in wanting, I think, to either make amends or, again, to give something back to the people that they've harmed. That is not allowed in our traditional system.
Let's see if we can get an idea of how some of these, I'll call them encounters, not confrontations, play out when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Jonathan Schaar, who is the director of the Restorative Justice Project at the UW Law School, and we're looking at these processes whereby a harmed individual can communicate directly with that person convicted of doing the harm and find out if they achieve their goals in doing that sort of thing. And you mentioned another reason, Jonathan, we didn't get into, about why a harmed person would want to do this, would want to actually confront one-on-one the person who had done the harm.
Yeah, so in addition to, again, the being curious about, again, the offense as well as the individual, there's two other things that come up for people. And sort of that first of those is wanting to let that person know how their life has been impacted, right? The sense of that, give them a better understanding of, like, after you did this, like, this is what my life has been like, right? Being able to be in that space, to be able to lay the harm that they've been carrying or the pain that they've been carrying back to that person.
Don't
right?
we see that in court, though, from time to time? I mean, even in news coverage of a trial, we see victims or relatives of victims saying, you've destroyed my life, I'll never get this person back, and that kind of thing.
So there's a portion of time, right? So you're talking about it, a sentencing hearing and the ability for a victim or survivor to make a victim impact statement. Again, you're very time limited in that space, as well as sort of what you're allowed in that sort of discretionary matter. The other thing is there something very different about a public process, being in a public courtroom, potentially with cameras, a lot of other people, and being able to have a confidential and private encounter with an individual to really look at these sort of deep pieces that maybe they didn't even feel comfortable sharing in open court. And then also think about, since this occurs sort of after that, what have they reflected on since then? Or what has it been like, right, in the year or 2 years since that person has been gone? Or how you've worked to put your life together since then, the growth that you may have done. And then similarly asking questions of them of, like, all right, what have you done since, right? Like, what have you done to address either these elements in yourself or those sorts of pieces? And the third thing as to why someone might want to do this is because they actually want to see that person do something proactive. Again, to be able to make amends or to repair some of the harm to the degree possible that that can be done. And so again, they may come in with very specific asks of an individual who is responsible for harm. And sometimes those have been, they wanted sort of public statements, you know, clearing up, you know, misunderstandings about what happened, or, you know, an apology or some sort of letter or statement to their family. Or sometimes we've even seen them, they say, hey, we want to speak with you in talking about this after you're sort of released, you know, giving presentations to public. So we've had a number of clients who've gone on after this dialogue process actually to sort of speak with, you know, education to public, to schools, to, you know, communities and other groups about that experience, to talk about and share both sides of harm and both sides of crime.
It seems to me, even in some, I'll call them extreme cases, where the person having done the harm and the person harmed will appear together in some mm-hmm. public forum.
Yeah. Yeah, so exactly like that, where again, they may be on a panel, or we may do this. I've hosted a number of these with former clients who've gone through this process that, again, we'll talk about that sense of exploring, right, that crime or exploring that harm. And then again, in a way of educating people, whether it's in sort of a, you know, if it's, you know, intoxicated driving or some sort of thing, or really just violence prevention, right? That sense of helping people to understand, you know, what it's like, both that experience of what led a person there, to hopefully, again, change the minor impact of a younger person so that they don't wind up in prison or incarcerated themselves, walking down that same path of harm to hopefully, you know, move them in a different direction.
What kind of option does the person incarcerated have in terms of saying, oh yeah, I'd like to go out and you know, meet and greet, but guess what, you're, you know, behind bars?
Yeah, very little sort of while they're incarcerated. I mean, there's been a couple limited exceptions for sort of what that looks like through particular programs in the state of Wisconsin. But yeah, otherwise, it's sensible. They either have to wait until they're done, right, until they may be released. Otherwise, what I've also seen, right, when that's the case, then that harm party says, well, you know what, then you've got an obligation in here. Right, that you have a community, even while you're incarcerated, to speak out, to educate people who are coming in, maybe people who, again, haven't done what you've done, but maybe along a similar track, to help influence them or impact them to shift their direction once they're released, right? So that we don't have, again, additional gun homicides or additional crimes to work in that way. And people take that very seriously, that sense of the obligation that they take on to mentor their peers or to be, again, peer support specialists, or to work in institutions to find ways of bringing something positive out of something really terrible that's happened.
Who tracks the results of these encounters?
Sure. Well, so the ones that we work with, I mean, we certainly are looking at some of those pieces of individuals and sort of do, you know, surveying and follow up of individuals at, you know, sort of various time intervals, just to check in to see what the impact is for people post when we bring them together. And the preparation process themselves, also just to understand, is quite lengthy. I mean, we spend months and months and months often preparing cases to get to the space of sort of a face-to-face encounter. And sometimes that even takes years.
Well, I can imagine there might be some advantage to that. Have you ever had, well, let me ask first, who would be present at these one-on-one
Sure.
encounters between the harmed and the one mm-hmm. having done the harm?
Yeah, so you have the two direct parties, and then each of those individuals has an opportunity or an option if they would choose to bring a support person in, whether that is, you know, a family member for, you know, again, a harmed party, or a friend, or it could be anybody, right? Sort of support person, therapist, whatever. And similar for the responsible party, if, you know, if they have a social worker in the institution or a chaplain or, you know, someone there that they would like with them, they have that option of being there. And then it is, so again, myself facilitating, and then sort of the students in our clinical program are present as well. So again, it's a pretty, you know, small group setting that we have to have these really challenging conversations.
Where do they take place?
Well, so for the individuals who are incarcerated, they take place at the institutions themselves. I mean, certainly they wouldn't, you know, sort of let somebody out just to do the talk and then, you know, see at 4 p.m.,
yeah.
Right? But understanding that, you know, it's usually special rooms, so there's separate rooms that we may use, conference rooms or, you know, particular spaces that are more private for individuals, that we do the dialogues directly at the institutions. For individuals who may be in the community, it's about finding what is a sort of a neutral space that feels safe for both individuals. And again, giving that first option to the harm party, like, where would you like to have this meeting? And then sort of seeing, you know, is that appropriate or amenable to the, you know, responsible party? And so we've done some even in sort of like community meeting rooms in libraries or at government buildings or probation parole offices, or again, sort of wherever you could have sort of a private space within a public setting. Where we can sort of control that environment has been the places where those occur in the community.
And the sparks fly?
So the meetings themselves are and can be quite emotional, but the sense is we spend so much time on the preparation phase that if we ever thought that there was sort of like risk to, again, anyone, either physical harm or anything, you know, happening that might leave people regretting to have done the process, we wouldn't do it. So the sense is we've never really had, again, we've never had a negative outcome, and you know, won't knock on wood here, but that sense of, again, if we take that time, if we've done our job appropriately, and which is why it takes so long to make sure that everyone is in the right place to meet, there is sort of agreed upon, like, here's what we're going to talk about. Also, it's a sense of, like, this is not about gotcha or shock moments. It's a sense of, like, this is about creating a shared narrative, right? Understanding people at this sort of human-to-human level. And so, yeah, is that emotional? Absolutely. Do people get upset and cry? Yes. But, you know, this is not a place where people are sort of shouting or yelling. That's not, you know, what happens in that space. Because, again, if that were to occur, obviously the meeting would be done, right? We'd be sort of at its end, and that opportunity would be you know, would be lost. But that doesn't mean that there aren't, again, very, like, intense and powerful moments that occur. 100%. Every dialogue has those. But it isn't sort of this level of, you know, what you might sort of think. Like, again, this is not sort of, you know, creating a talk show, you know, mentality. Again, yeah. This is about, we want positive outcomes because we want each person to leave this process at a better space than when they came in. And notice I said each person, right? Our goal, right, again, is that both parties, you know, enter at one level and sort of leave at a much higher level, feeling some amount of healing, feeling some amount of, you know, relief, or feeling, again, that they're taking something positive away from this experience.
What sort of spectrum of responses, reactions have you gotten from the harmers in these meetings? I mean, I can see on the one hand where those harmed would, you know, could get very emotional and,
oh, sure,
and reopening the wounds, but what about the reaction of the person who has been convicted of harming?
You know, just as similar. What's interesting is the power dynamic is completely flipped when we think about restorative justice, right? Because this is a sense of where you've got a harmed party requests this process. A harmed party sort of sets, you know, kind of the agenda and sort of sets this off. You know, a harmed party is like determines kind of like when we're there and ready for this meeting, right? They're the first ones that look at sort of the outline and craft the sense of what they're looking for. They get this sort of choice of, like, what does the room look like, right? Like, who sits where? Who's in the room first? Like, that sense of control, which, again, in the context of crime, is in the hands of the party who's responsible for that. In this restorative space, it's about crafting and re-empowering the person who's been harmed. And so giving them that power back, you know, is tremendously liberating for them. And so that sense of, what do we see from the harmed party, we see those very same emotions, a sense of, you see deep and intense shame. There are some cases where, you know, we walk or we bring a survivor into a room and that responsible party just immediately bursts into tears, right? Or just immediately just is, again, crying uncontrollably and apologizing so profusely. And there are others, again, that they really think about the sense of, it's about, and I hear this time and time again, it's like, well, there's not much I can do for them, right? So it's whatever they want, whatever I can do for them. That sense of when they look at this impact and ripple effect, sort of seeing the more full range of their actions and responses, but also being received in a way that acknowledges their humanity, allows them to take the masks off, allows them to lower the guards down, and just sort of sees them as another person. And so what we see are, yeah, some really tremendous and dramatic transformations across this process of someone that they feel very, again, in a lot of ways, they're scared. They're often as scared or more scared than the harm party sort of coming in. And they worry about those same things. They're like, well, geez, is this person going to, you know, jump over the table or whatever?
For weapons.
Yeah, and certainly, again, nothing like that has ever happened, but they're still nervous about that. And I found that really interesting that a lot of times you might have both parties are as scared of one another, which, you know, seems strange to some people, but it is that sense of, once we sort of change the dynamic and the balance in the sense of that we're here sort of seeing people as people, and we're not in the context of the crime itself, that it's a very different relationship between individuals. And then you have cases that occur where harm parties are people in their family, right? Where they've been separated from their family, whether it's a domestic homicide or some sort of, you know, sexual-based crime that occurred, or, you know, a child who was harmed or hurt, or child abuse, or sort of things. So we have deep and complex human relationships that may go beyond anything that's just sort of like stranger to stranger, right? The sense is, individuals, you know, who seek this out, again, fall all over that sort of spectrum of what is the connection between the people. And so, yeah, we see a lot of deep remorse. We see a lot of people actually taking accountability for what they've done. But like I said, that energy that you see sort of in that room and the way that power dynamic is flipped, where again, the victim at any point can be like, you know what, I'm done with this, right? Or they could get up and sort of leave. And so it is that sense of returning that to them and giving them back the control. Hopefully not just the situation, but also of their own lives.
Question that might sound a little trivial, but it I think has meaning. In these one-on-one encounters, what's the shape of the conference table?
I mean, often sort of rectangular. you know, it's a sort of whatever table kind of exists in the space that we're in. I mean, certainly they could be circular. I mean,
how close are the harmer and the harmed?
You know, that can be anywhere from, you know, a couple feet, right? It's going to be
really,
you know, 2-3 feet just across sort of a standard kind of conference table. We've had individuals even who sit sort of, you know, kitty corner right there where, again, there's sort of no one kind of in between the two of them. Otherwise, again, it might be sort of me at, you know, at one end of the table and then sort of the, you know, the parties on either side of me, you know, across from one another. And sometimes they want to, you know, they don't want to sit directly across from them. And sometimes rather than sort of the short edge of a rectangular table, maybe the long edge, right? Like they, again, determine that sort of sense, like I said, of who's in the room first, you know, who speaks first, you know, what does this sort of look like? All these sort of things that you sort of say are absolutely not trivial in thinking about attending to these small details that make all the difference in the world to people once they get into that space. And I've had lots of clients comment on that. They're like, why are they asking us all these questions about these sort of things? And I was like, well, because once you get into that moment, it actually is going to make a big difference to you as to what this looks like and what it feels like for you.
Can you recall for us some specific resolutions in these encounters?
Do you mean how they
went? How
did
they end?
Sure. I mean, they end a whole bunch of different ways. A lot of times, right, we get here, we ask them sort of these dramatic stories. And yes, absolutely, I have a whole bunch of dramatic stories that do end in those spaces of, you know, whether that's sort of forgiveness or that do end in some sort of embrace or,
really?
You know, whether that's a hug or a handshake or, again, just a, you know, a nod. And it really is, again, what does the victim want, right? Like, what do they want? What is their reasoning for coming into this space? And sometimes what it means is not just how it sort of ends, but then what comes next. And so some we've done a second dialogue, if that's sort of been necessary, or we've done dialogues with different family members. In other cases, it's been bringing families together. In other cases, then they may start sort of a letter exchange that happens sort of through us, like sort of continued communication. So it can look a whole bunch of different ways.
We'll get a sense of how these things are tracked after the fact as time progresses when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Jonathan Shar, who is the director of the Restorative Justice Project at the UW Law School. And we've gotten into this whole phenomenon of encounters, confrontations, or just, you might say, meetings between the harmed and those convicted of harming them in the legal system, and how these things often, very often, are resolved in some fairly friendly way during these encounters. Do you have a way of tracking, though, does that kind of communication between the harmed and those convicted of harming continue after these meetings?
So we look at each of those, again, on a case-by-case basis. And so there may be a couple instances even where we do a follow-up dialogue or a second dialogue for any number of reasons. Otherwise, there are individuals that may engage in sort of letter correspondence that occur through our program. Again, so it's not direct communication, but it's still monitored and, you know, sort of flows through us where we have, where we've done that. And then there are cases where, again, maybe they've done two dialogues or there's some sort of reason where they do ultimately sort of develop some sort of written communication relationship or those things. And there's been even in some more extreme cases, the sense of where, you know, an individual has gotten on a person's visiting list, right? And has, you know, invested in that person's sort of success in the you know, in the legal system or in our, you know, prison system, and want to see them be successful upon release.
The cases we've been talking about so far have been matters of conviction. Mm-hmm. But there are other nuances, degrees of legal system handling situations like this, one of which is the plea bargain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a few different ways in which, again, this, you know, people can find their way to us that don't involve sort of a post-adjudicative setting where someone isn't convicted of a crime. And one can be, again, for, you know, there might be a case that has multiple victims and, you know, as a result of sort of a plea that no new cases may be able to be brought. We've, you know, seen that most sort of in the sexual harm realm, potentially, where there's an individual with sort of multiple victims. And, you know, additionally, you know, you can have cases that get sort of dismissed and or, you know, read in, you know, or counts of, you know, of harm, you know, dismissed and read into another case. And so the sense of there, they may not be sort of a victim of record anymore, but it doesn't mean that they're not a victim. It doesn't mean that they haven't been harmed or experienced harm and that they don't deserve sort of restorative sponsored restorative outcome for them. And then there's still another group of individuals where, you know, sort of the crime or harm, you know, when it sort of, you know, surfaces or comes to light or comes to a space where they feel okay to address it, that the statute of limitations has passed.
I mean, certainly that's not. We see that a lot with some of these sexual abuse cases.
Yeah. So, you don't necessarily see them often in some of the homicide cases, depending on what that is, but you will see them much more frequently in sort of sexual harm based cases where statute of limitations have passed. And obviously that has continued to change and evolve as our laws have continued to change and evolve, but there are still individuals that have found themselves, you know, kind of, you know, for lack of a better phrase, on the outside looking in when they think about wanting some sort of response. And then there's a whole other group of individuals, and quite frankly, a large group of individuals that aren't that interested in what our traditional legal system or criminal processes have to offer in recognizing how traumatizing they can be, you know, whether this is a sexual harm case or something else, where they don't want to do nothing, but they also don't necessarily want to go through sort of a full criminal prosecution or that full sort of core process. And so we've had individuals there who've reached out as well. And so those, again, really complex to handle, but certainly things that we've approached and done numerous times in the past. And so there's a lot of different pathways that people get to us. It's appropriate for a lot more things than most people have sort of considered and use in a lot of different contexts. And so we know that it's been very, very effective in its multiple uses. Again, sort of mentioned earlier, the, you know, empirical data we've got around it of, you know, the outcomes of reducing recidivism and sort of successfully resolving cases and sort of looking at longer term outcomes for individuals when it comes to thinking about procedural justice or how, again, for sort of a victim or, you know, survivor of crime, how they're doing long term, whether psychologically or, you know, emotionally or how they feel about the crime or about this other person.
That does raise an interesting question, Jonathan. What kind of track record do you see when it comes to recidivism?
Sure. So looking at, again, our cases, so it becomes a little bit challenging, especially for individuals, right? So we're first degree intentional homicide, right? Where they might be serving life sentences where they're, you know, never necessarily going to get out, or individuals.
No chance.
Yeah, serving very, very long sentences. So what I will say is, you know, obviously for those individuals, you know, well, I can't speak right to that because they aren't necessarily released. For the individuals who have been released, there honestly have only been, that I'm aware of all the people that I've personally worked with over the last, you know, more than a decade, two individuals who ended up reincarcerated. One was actually for sort of a, as we sort of talk about the, you know, crimeless revocation, right? So a rules violation that wasn't a new sort of criminal act. And another was, again, sort of a drunk driving originating case that, again, the person relapsed and there was sort of another instance of drunk driving, though, you know, not no sort of bodily harm. No one was injured. Mm-hmm. But still, again, after you've done something that seriously impacts people, you know, the response was, you know, that there was a new criminal charge or criminal case. But, you know, beyond that, you know, the people that we have worked with have been, you know, very successful in the community, have done some, you know, pretty incredible things in the ways that they've sort of transformed their life. And others have just tried to get back to their life, right? To sort of, you know, stay below the radar and just, you know, move on with the business of living.
Is the emphasis really in this restorative justice, would you say it's primarily for the sake of the person who has been harmed and for them to move on, get over it, maybe even forgive the person who has done the harm?
Yeah. So I will say, yes, it's centered on the person who's experienced harm, right? Looking at what do they want to achieve. I also think about this idea of a question I ask a lot of people at the beginning is, you know, how would you hope to feel at the end of this? Right. And so that sense of that's, you know, kind of more important, whether that's like, geez, you know, it would really be good if I could get a good night's sleep, right? Mm-hmm. Or be able to feel like I, you know, can breathe easier if I wasn't as worried or I didn't have as much anxiety or I didn't think about this as much. And so those have been some outcomes I've really, really loved. You know, when I do check in or follow up with somebody, you know, a couple months after and they tell me, oh, you know, Jonathan, I haven't really thought about this since this happened. And I say, great. Mm-hmm. Like that tells me that there's been a lot of growth that you've been able to let a lot of this go. You know, another instance that sticks with me a lot is there was an attempted homicide case and an individual, you know, she talked about sort of the extreme violence that she experienced in this relationship and that ultimately, again, nearly cost her life. And she said for, you know, about 2 decades, you know, 3 to 5 times a week, she would have night terrors or waking up, not being able to sleep and in a panic. And, you know, I checked in again sort of several months after this dialogue and all of those were gone. And so I don't know what sort of one good night's worth of sleep is worth, but when I compound that at 3 to 5 times a week, you know, times 20 years, I view that as a really, really good use of our time in the way that we look at people. And that really actually matches up a lot with the data that says that, you know, people are, you know, tremendously less likely to sort of fear this other individual or fear recidivism, right? The re-victimization that they may experience, you know, that sense of what we see is, you know, anywhere between 30 to 50% reduction in sort of long-term sort of stress. And they can, you know, sort of, they've done some longitudinal studies in Canada and elsewhere that followed sort of survivors of crime who've gone through a restorative process for 7+ years in looking at, like, again, what are these sort of psychological, emotional, and sort of other physiological responses that they see with people. And so dramatically reduce sort of fear of the individual, as well as sort of a lot better sort of well-being. We think about this as sort of a public health matter. We think about it as sort of long-term, the way that they're doing themselves, that when they're less anxious, when they're less fearful and are sort of like less worried about this other person or about experiencing this sort of harm again, and they don't see this person as a monster, but instead just see them as an individual, right? Whether that was like a young kid who made a terrible choice or another individual experiencing, you know, sort of addiction and substance abuse or what other things may be going on with their life, or that that person who's responsible for harm has addressed some of the trauma they've experienced. Looking at where each person is, again, is really, really important. But again, centered on where does this person who's experienced harm go? So touching lastly on this sort of forgiveness piece, and I leave this for last because often that is what people want to focus on, right? These sort of dramatic experience of forgiveness. And does that happen? Yes. But I think if it's a byproduct, great. But that is not the intention. That's not a prerequisite. You know, that's not something I tell people to sort of come in sort of thinking about or expecting, because otherwise that sets this out of reach for a lot of people. It
could be a really heavy lift.
I mean, it's just not necessarily realistic, right? That sense of a person, right? If the only view of restorative justice that they see is this dramatic forgiveness story, they says, well, I'm not there, that says this to them, well, this isn't for me. But that's not true, because the sense is, what I focus on is, what can we do for you to help you on your healing journey? Some of my favorite stories are non-forgiveness stories, in the way that someone comes out of this experience and says, you know what, I don't forgive you. But then when I hear from them sort of later, what I hear is that, you know, maybe their anger and hatred for the world is gone. One of my favorite stories, right, is this very instance where someone has said, like, I don't forgive you. I don't hate you anymore. But I can't forgive you for what you've done, right? Because that means X, Y, Z. And so again, forgiveness is a tricky subject, because each person, you know, if you poll 10 people, you might get 9 different definitions of what forgiveness means. Who is it for? What does it require? Is there a prerequisite? Do they have to ask for it, right? All these sort of things that, you know, we think about it very simplistically in our culture and societally, but it's actually a really complex thing. And so again, if we think about what outcomes do people want to see, and if that's this idea of they want to make some meaning about what's happened, they want to address some of the harm that's occurred. Again, if forgiveness happens, great. But that sense of there doesn't need to be sort of the words, that doesn't need to be a thing. And if someone says, again, they can visit their child's grave for the first time and not weep, that they can think about them and think about them with joy, if they can think about good memories versus the ways that their life ended. And then one of the coolest letters I ever received was from someone who started in a really, really difficult space, was holding on to a lot of anger, a lot of bitterness, and a lot of pain. And speaking with that individual sort of months after our face-to-face meeting that we had had with the responsible party, you know, they hadn't told anyone in their life that they were doing this process. But people at their work and people that they encountered, they were like, what's different? Like, what you do? Like, they notice that this person wasn't carrying that anger, that bitterness, that sort of resentment that they may have felt, sort of the pent-up spaces of anger and pain that they were holding on so tightly, such that they didn't tell anyone, but people know something's different. They're like, what did you do, right? And it's not like, hey, what'd you do to your hair, right? That sense of what has transformed you in a way that has allowed you to enjoy life or engage in life in a very different way before. And so there's been some really powerful experiences and stories that I've heard from people in the ways in which they live differently, the way that they sort of view the world, that they're not, again, angry or don't possess hatred for the world or for all kinds of people around them, that instead they can engage in the business of living.
If they were a victim before, they are no longer a victim.
Yeah, that sense of that they've moved from that victim space, right, to a space of survivor, and hopefully even beyond that to thriver, right? The sense of someone moving on with their life in a way that allows them to add value and experience joy and experience really their, again, sort of their family and their friends in a beautiful way.
Can you give us a sense before we go, Jonathan, of the scope? How many of these situations has the Restorative Justice Project curated?
Sure. So we often have a typical caseload anywhere from, you know, 30 to, well, I mean, sometimes 30, even 40 requests sort of that we might be working on at a time, all in sort of various parts of that sort of preparation process. We are a project or program that started back in 1987. And so the throwback, the old sort of term, you'd mentioned reconciliation earlier, it started as what came out of Canada as a sort of victim offender reconciliation program, right? We've sort of advanced sort of well beyond that in the decades since, but sort of as a program, it's sort of the oldest educational or experiential learning program in the country that I'm aware of that sort of does this restorative justice work and has handled a really significant number of cases in these sort of, again, sort of serious and sensitive harm spaces. And so, you know, personally, I know as a program, we've done hundreds and hundreds of these cases over sort of several decades. Again, I've been here since sort of 2013 and have, again, felt the great fortune to have the opportunity of, you know, working with hundreds of different survivors and their families to be able to invite it into the darkest, deepest spaces of their lives, the deepest pits of pain and despair that they may feel, and help sort of, again, just walking beside them and explaining what we can and getting their questions answered to hopefully have them end at a place where, again, they have no need for us. Something that I joke about with people when we're done, they're like, hey, don't take this the wrong way, but I hope I never see you again, right? And I say, I wish you the same, right? The sense of I never want anyone to have to experience what someone has experienced that brought them to me in the first place. And so I take great delight, right, if I don't have to see them again and instead that they're in a space of great personal growth and of peace.
And somebody can look up online Restorative Justice Project and find out how to connect with you.
Yeah, so we're available. Survivors of crime can apply directly for this program right on our website. Otherwise, you can find us through the Office of Victim Services and Programs with the Department of Corrections. Or again, finding me, online or in the directory and sending me an email. However people find us, I'm always pleasantly, surprised how that happens. But I feel it's like, at the right time, right? That sense of they find us hopefully when they need us and that when we can help them.
Jonathan Schar, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Norman.
I'm Norman Gilliland. Our engineer is Emily Ralph, and I hope you'll join me next time around for University of the Air.